Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, saving you money on your annual bike, scooter and moped insurance.
Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Right then. Today's guest is an absolute legend on two wheels, having raced at the highest level, British Superbikes, World Superbikes, Isle of Man TT, the Manx Grand Prix, just about everything you have seen on a racetrack, he has absolutely done it. He's also a fantastic television presenter, a race commentator, road tester. He runs his own race tuition school. And on top of that, if that's not enough, he runs his own airport. The man is an absolute god, the one and only James Whittam. Morning, James.
Morning, boys. A fair bit of exaggeration going on there, but I quite enjoyed it, yeah.
Well, enjoy it. I don't write the introductions, but just take it, mate.
Anyway, what a wonderful introduction, James. Obviously, Ewan is in fine form this morning. I mean, the one that, of all the things that stick out, and we're going to get stuck into most of those from the introduction, Huddersfield International Airport. Could you expand on that? How did you get involved in that?
Yeah, well, actually, that's the newly renamed this last couple of years. We've called it Huddersfield International Airport because we can. You can call it whatever you want. You can call your house whatever you want, I guess. It is actually traditionally known as Crossland Moor Airfield. It was a little airfield on top of a sort of Pennine moor built by David Browns, if you've heard of them, the tractor people. The guy also owned Aston Martin, which is why Aston Martin is a DB, David Brown, if you didn't know that.
Oh, never knew that.
That's why they designated DNB, because he bought the company back when his tractor company were doing well. They got into financial... It was their private airfield for their private aeroplane. My dad bought it in the early 70s. I was brought up here, and it's just pretty much a stretch of about half a mile of tarmac with a couple of old rusty sheds and some aeroplanes and motorbikes and equipment.
Wow. Sounds like Leeds Bradford Airport, James, doesn't it? Let's be brutally honest, mate.
What started happening, I do a little bit of flying in a really, really sort of amateurish way. But I'm quite keen. I do like me flying. It's a similar thing to motorcycling to me. It's a very, controlling a mechanical thing is a pleasurable thing for me, and I'm sure you'd agree with being into bikes. It's actual control part that gets me in. Flying's the same as bikes. Well, I actually did fly off to Latuke just to get a coffee and to go over the channel just for a challenge. So we are now calling it Huddersfield International Airport. We're international because a couple of us have been abroad. And we are still down in the books as Crossland. We are going to alter it. But I like doing that because we get the odd call from Manchester International Airport and Leeds Bradford International Airport, and I like just sometimes you're tracing aircraft that have been through their space and all that kind of thing, and I like saying to them, yes, this is Huddersfield International Airport, and I'd like to know what they're thinking, but it is just a field basically with a bit of tarmac on.
Like, mate, we talk about things with engines. Like, I've got to say, we're on Series 3 and we have a lot of sort of celebs, if you want, who come on here and like, oh, I didn't know you rode a bike. Tell us all about it. It's quite interesting. But yeah, we're a similar age. But I have to say, me growing up, I've always associated bikes with you, like literally watching you be a world-class racer and then across, you know, commentating, presenting. Is it in your veins? Is it something that was passed down from generations? Because with me... I want to hear your name. Oh, yeah, the motorbike guy. I mean, you are Mr. Motorbiking.
Yeah, I think it came down from my dad, really. I think a lot of most people who get into motorcycles is down to an uncle or a mate or more often a dad that's into bikes. And I grew up with it. So from being 6 or 7 onwards, my dad had me watching the TT. We'd go watch late 70s. We went to watch Transatlantic, if you remember that, where the Americans came over, used to race with the Brits, people like Kenny Roberts and Steve Baker and Sheen and Grant and Ditchburn, all them kind of people. So it was in my blood. Plus the fact I was lucky enough to be brought up from being 4 onwards on the airfield here, so we had a lot of space. So we could get field bikes and mess about with old cars and anything mechanical me and my mates would get stuck into, because we had room and we also had space, so we didn't offend anybody. You know, if you live next door to somebody, driving around your garden on a flipping C90 with no exhaust on is probably going to piss off your neighbours. But we were lucky enough that everybody with a motorcycle in the locale, every kid had come up to my place because they couldn't really do a lot of damage or offend a lot of people. So, yeah, it is in my blood, yeah.
Question about heroes. I mean, you've just answered there with reeling off some really iconic names. But I suppose dovetailed in with that, as you're saying, James, to be able to have... Because that's the other part about it. We've spoken to many people who may have done a bit of kind of under-the-radar biking as without a licence on a big patch of grass or wherever. But the fact that you had that much ability and space there to be able to do that. So that then means, I presume, does the bike then from a very early age just become second nature to you? It almost becomes an extended body part. Once you get on it, it's you're back at home, you know exactly what you're doing, you know exactly what each and every bit does.
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on. I don't know where it comes from having been on bikes that long, but I know from being, I started racing at 16 and went through the sort of classes from 125, I started off at 125s, little two strokes, right, with perhaps 30 brake horsepower, not a lot of power, club racing. And then before you know it, you end up and you're racing super bikes at a national level, a world level even, if you're lucky enough. And you spend that, I spent 20 years on bikes the whole time. And it, yeah, that sort of muscle memory thing where I've had it during winter where we've maybe missed a bit of testing because of weather or whatever, and you haven't been on a motorcycle for, let's say, not a race bike anyway, for a couple of months, and you think, God, this is going to be alien. I'm not going to know what I'm doing here when I get to the first meeting or the first test. And you know what? Within half a lap, you know what you're doing. It works. Everything works. Your fingers work properly. You kind of can, and I'm sure that's the same as most other sports. You get that far into it and figure it out that much and think about it that much and do it that much, that it just becomes natural.
A second nature, I suppose. It's second nature. But when you were like 14 or whatever, riding 125s, and then you said there quite flippantly, before you know it, you're on super bikes. When you're 14, 15, most people say, before you know it, you've got two paper rounds. But I'm not saying you're blasé about it, but did you know you had a gift for riding motorbikes then? At what stage did you think, hang on a minute, I could make a living from this, I'm good enough to race with the big boys? When did you know that?
I think it's a bit different then. I think the mindset we were brought up with, certainly in the north, was the fact that you had to go and prove yourself. Now, all kids are told by the parents, everyone knows them, no matter what they do, whether they're dancing or racing bikes or whatever, they're playing football, they're told from the very beginning that they are going to be the best. You know, you can do anything if you want to, if you put enough work into it. And I get all that. And I'm a little bit like that with my kid. She's 22 now and she's doing all right. But we were, I don't know if this is a northern thing or might be just my family thing, but we were brought up to believe that you're going to be useless unless you proved otherwise. You know, so I never had parents that would heap praise on you. It was, go on then, off you go. Let's see what we can do. It was very much so. At no point did I get into racing thinking I was going to be anything other than a guy going around having fun at a club race, and that's all I wanted. But then you start winning a couple of races and you start thinking, oh, hang on a minute here. Maybe I could, you know, I've won a couple of club races. Maybe we can do that last national championship race of the season. And then you go and do that. And then that, you start to get results at national level. So it's really incremental in my case. I don't know whether people of my generation were the same or whether they did believe from the beginning. And I know that Foggy always, I mean, a good mate with Cal Fogarty. To this day, we're good mates. And he's a very different bloke to me, in that he always said he knew that he had talent, he knew he could. And even now, he was, whatever, 7 times world champ. Absolutely brilliant rider. Loads and loads of respect for what he could do on a bike. But he would look back on his career as a complete failure because he didn't get to 500 GPs and beat Doohan several times, you know, in a championship. So that's a different mindset. I look back at my career and I think, bloody hell, that was all right. You know, I didn't think I'd ever be able to do that. So I'm sure my way is easier to live with whatever you've done somehow. But maybe, I mean, Carl always says that if I'd have been more, you know, more determined. I was really determined when we trained. I was as fit as anybody on the track. I was more able and prepared to take a risk than most on track, which is why I fell off a little bit. But Carl said if you'd have believed in your own ability a bit more, you'd have been better. And maybe he's right, but I still look back and I think I thought I overachieved, really, from where I came from. So it's quite easy to live with myself these days.
The mentality there, James, is absolutely fascinating because you are absolutely right with that. We work back from it's almost, and without getting to a broader debate about bringing up kids, it's like the cult of the child, isn't it? Everything revolves around them and everything is making sure that their life is as comfortable as possible, which when it comes to kind of assessing human nature in 1,000 years' time, they might look back and go, oh my God, what on earth were you doing? You need to almost kind of not out the crib, slap them on the arse and send them on the way. But that, to what you're saying there is, because that's as much developing hunger and ambition in yourself, because you want to prove it to yourself, you want to prove it to your parents, you want to prove it to the people that you come across. But, and Foggy being the way Foggy is, you can have a real kind of common ground in the middle, but your approaches can be alien to each other, because if you're a Foggy, this is a different conversation. If he's James, that's a different conversation. So I think it all makes it up in that particular respect. It's such a fascinating look at the mindset of it, because when you were a kid and what you think about aspiring to on an airfield, on a windy moor, are you thinking about Donington, Alton Park? Are you thinking about the TT? Are you then going, because another big thing nowadays is if you can't see it, you can't be it. But if you're watching footage of someone at the TT on a television set, I mean, it's like me watching the FA Cup final as a kid. You're going, well, that looks like a Hollywood. It looks like a world away. Doesn't stop you dreaming about being there, though, does it?
No, I always dreamed about being there, but I didn't think it'd ever happen. A lot, you know, for the most part. And
when not in a pessimistic sense. I mean, you're not suddenly going, ugh, you know what I mean? It'll never happen to me. You're kind of going, well, that feels like a world away. I'll crack on with what's in front of me. And as you said, which Ewan picked up on, and you said it in such a wonderful way. I did this and I moved on to that. And it was in such a self-effacing way. Next minute, I'm riding super bikes and you're there going, sorry, that... that's how it went for you, and it's fine to be matter of fact about it, because that's potentially how it felt a little bit. It sounds like,
yeah, and it did feel like that. I was always really, really happy to be doing what I was doing. I could never quite believe that somebody were paying me decent money to do something that I really enjoyed doing. You know, you'd never say this to anybody. Oh, well, I am going to do. I'd have almost done it for nothing. You know, if somebody had paid me a few money, I'd have gone and done a world championship race. You know, and I think definitely looking back, it was a more enjoyable way of going racing. And again, Carla disagreed with me. He would say, well, you've got to be, you know, you weren't serious enough. Well, I was serious. I was very, very serious about my racing, and probably fitter than he ever was, to be quite honest. And I would definitely take a bigger risk than Carl, probably with less talent, but he always seemed to be angry around his racing. You know, at a meeting, he was always on edge, angry, expecting a better of himself. You know, even if he won both races by 10 seconds on a superbike weekend, he would say that he should have won them by 20 seconds. You know, and I'd end up on a podium with him thinking, bloody hell, look at this. Look at us here.
Do you know what, James? I think that's a lovely way to live, because you look back at your career with fond memories and almost like pinch me, because I actually got paid to do something I love doing. And I'll tell you now, I know it's a different sport, but you were probably the type of rider who would rattle your opponents, because I used to race against on the track people who, like, I thought, you know, perhaps weren't that hungry for it and would do really well, and had a really relaxed way about racing. Like you said, you could go to a race weekend and be so stressed out like a Foggy, and it's all about this, whereas you can go in quite relaxed, ride, keep relaxed, and in some people's minds maybe overachieve, and you think, well, hang on, that's pretty good. And I think actually the way you've lived your career, and we'll go on to it, but you're still having a fantastic career within the biking world. So not only were you good, you were likable and people liked you, and that's why you still work within motorbikes. But I think actually that's probably a nice way to live, mate, the fact that you can look back and think, yeah, that I did all right, you know. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, and I really enjoy now. I enjoy the fact that you get quite famous. Being a motorcycle racer isn't like being a footballer. If you're a famous footballer, a lot of people know you. And you, athletics, it's a big thing. Motorcycling, no matter what you think, is a niche kind of sport, pastime, call it what you want. And yeah, I don't want much out of this, but just occasionally I'll walk out of a shop somewhere and somebody will say, oh, yeah, I saw your race at Cadwell, whatever. And I love that. And it doesn't have to happen every day, but just occasionally, just to somebody to sort of doff the cap, is really quite a nice thing. We were out mountain biking in Derbyshire, 4 or 5 hours, and we blocked the whole pavement up because we needed to, we got like flipping 10 grand mountain bikes, and we needed to see him while we had his tea in this little cafe. And we blocked the pavement by jamming them up against the window so we could still see him. And this guy couldn't, old guy, as we walked out after we finished this coffee, this old fella was struggling to get past the bikes. Real old fella. In his 80s, maybe. And he was tutting. And I said, hey, whoa, we're really nice people. We just needed to see these bikes as we had as tea. That's all I don't want them nicking. And he just looked at me and he just says, you weren't so nice when you were riding that superbike, were you? Winked and walked off. And I thought, do you know what? Made my week. That has. And that's, you know, it sounds big-headed that you want, what's the word?
No.
You want
validation, isn't it? Yeah.
But just occasionally it's nice that somebody actually... Yeah.
Well, why it's nice, Jack? Why it's nice? After him.
You should meet Carl Fogarty. He's a right miserable sob.
Yeah.
Well, Carl, honestly, will probably watch this at some point. I love Carl. We have a really good time together. But a couple of times when he was at the height of his sort of powers, and he was flipping good, no matter what, you know, he was just a good rider. He could ride a motorbike properly. He had a lot of natural talent. A lot of times he didn't know why he was doing it. He put it down to the fact that he was more determined than it. And, you know, I'm not sure about any of that. But anyway, fast man. And really well known, with that even, especially when he'd done that jungle thing, you know, he was no outside of motorcycling. So I rang him up and said, look, me and the missus are going to come over and we're going to go out. We'll meet in Manchester. He's from Blackburn, I'm from Huddersfield, equidistant to Manchester. Good night out is Manchester, really good place. So we'll go to a restaurant in Manchester. Yeah, get some booked. Me and Mikhail, I'll meet you in Annabelle. Right, perfect. So I'll ring you back 10 minutes later. Right, I booked Bar and Grill. Oh, no, I can't go there. Why? Well, I'll get my head and I'll get bothered. You know, I can't go in there. Right, okay, leave it with me. 10 minutes later, I've rang you back. Right, we're going to Caluccio's. No, I can't go there. Why? Well, I'll get bothered. And by the fourth call, I'm getting pissed off. And I've said, look, mate, I booked us in there. Right, you're going, wind your neck in. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it. And so he grumpily says, so with me, we sat there half an hour, nobody's come up and asked him or said anything to him. And then he's looking round, looking for somebody to come and flip and say hello to him. And I just think, what do you want? You can't have it both ways.
Oh, that's brilliant. But going back to that old man outside the cafe who sort of doffed his capture, so to speak, how nice is that? That not only we've talked about you've made a living out of something you love doing, but you've clearly brought pleasure to millions and millions of people who have been gone for the Brits and watching you race. And how nice does that make you feel? And how proud are you when you look back at your great career and think, yeah, do you know what? A lot of people were rooting for me. I made a lot of people proud. That must be lovely.
I think I was... and you mean, the pair of you know all about this. You go about... I never... tried to do anything just to be popular. I wanted to race my motorbike, but also brought up in a way that you did have a bit of respect for people, and I did want acceptance, I guess, from people. And I loved the idea that people saw, and sometimes this was the case and sometimes it wasn't. I loved the idea that people thought you were putting 110% in and taking a risk and putting yourself out there to fail sometimes, you know. And I quite enjoyed that. I'd get people coming up, and I still do occasionally. I'll get somebody coming up to you and saying, oh, I used to be a marshal at Cadwell Park, picked you up a few times, and I think I quite like that as well. You know, the fact that...
James, you can't even... you can't even imagine a life like James's. That's a proper sport, not a soft footballer and gets paid too much.
You'd never get a referee walking up to you 10 years later and go, I've told you to sod off 20 years ago, but because that's probably what I was saying to them. It's the memories that you're talking about, James, are so fascinating. So then it puts us in the direction of asking the question with regards to when that then stops. You talk about your approach to racing and I think that the humility is there for us all to see and the self-deprecation, but you were obviously very, very, very good. But that approach of thinking, I'm just happy to be here and feeling that right in here and loving it, when it comes to having to call it a day, we've spoken to many races over the course of the couple of seasons that we've done, like some Hickey and Steve Parrish, James Hillier, Toesland as well, had to retire through injury. When it comes to that very final time when you've got to make a decision, because you enjoyed it in the way that you did that make it easier or harder to come away from actually doing it competitively?
I think for me it was easy. I think I'd got to... People go on a bit longer now. People race till in the 40s. I think they tend to stay a bit fitter in the fact they don't hurt themselves as much. There's still big accidents in motorcycling. We know that. These things are, you know, when you're in 200 miles an hour, 6 inches away from somebody else who is doing the same thing and wanting the same thing, then there's an inherent risk, especially at places like the TT, Northwest, Ulster Grand Prix, road circuits, etc. But even on short circuits, inherent risk, which is one of the good things for me. I love the fact that racing had an element of danger. But actually, I think now they hurt themselves in a... We were always carrying a broken collarbone, broken ankle, soaking a cast off. That's less the case now. They still have the big crashes, but there's less of the little sort of tucks and knocks and dings and broken collarbones. So I think people are able to stay fitter and go on longer. Half the British Championship front runners in BSB are over, you know, getting on for 40 or over 40. So that's brilliant. My day, people had finished by the time they were early 30s, generally. And at about 35, 36, I'm doing World Super Sport. And competitively, I won rounds every single year. Finished third one year, fourth in the championship the next. So I was in the mix. And it was my living. So that's another thing you've got to think about. You've got to, you're going to have to do something else to earn a living. And but it always had magic to me. I always go, even if I'd been questioning myself over the winter, we'd go testing in January, maybe in Spain or Australia or wherever, Southern Hemisphere generally, or somewhere warm. You can't test in Britain. And I've generally, I was racing for a foreign team anyway, the last 3 years for an Italian team. And I'd go testing at Almeria, wherever, Eastern Creek in Australia, and you'd see your bike with your name on it, brand new colours, new leathers that turned up, new helmet. And You, the magic's there still. It's there. You're just looking at your bike in the garage thinking, man, here we go again. And I didn't. I was 36 and we went testing before the... And I had a contract for the 03 season. And magic had gone. I'm looking at my bike at the test in the garage as the mechanics worked on the bike thinking, I don't know whether this is... something's changed here.
Wow.
And I didn't say anything. I tested, and we tested pretty well. And on the flight on the way home, I just thought, you're done, aren't you? If you're thinking that, and if somebody's gone to that much, somebody's putting hundreds of or millions into your effort, you know, flipping Arctic trucks, flipping, going out to, it was actually, we were at Almeria, that's where the test was. And I came home thinking, you're done. And
just as an emotional kind of hit in the stomach or in your head or in your heart, you looked at
it. I knew that to put as much effort in as I needed to do, that it was going to be not possible if I wasn't completely sort of invested in it at that point of the season, you know. So I knew something had changed. Plus the fact my missus were pregnant. All the most of the previous year, and we'd had a kid at the end of 2002. Maybe that was a thing. And I don't know.
With the kid, do you think then you became a little bit more self-aware of perhaps the risks of doing that for a living in terms of, you know, you're living for more than just yourself now, aren't you?
Yeah, and everybody's had a kid, no matter what you do for a living, your life becomes less about you and more about providing and nurturing your kid and protecting your kid. And maybe that was a thing. Or maybe I was just old. I'd had a really big crash in 2002 the year before, and I actually didn't hurt myself that bad, but I've pinged myself eye-sided coming out. There's some. You've ridden Brands Hatch, haven't you?
I've been round there.
So last corner, clearways, there's some big rollers. They're not bumps. They're like big sort of rollers where the bike... And on a super sport back then, we'd probably about 130 brake horsepower. It was borderline whether you got tucked in to try and drag a bit more speed onto the start and finish, or you stayed, some people said, sort of lent off a little bit. And I tucked right in, and I'm behind the bubble, lit one of these rollers, the thing lit up as the tyre unloaded, and flipping, it actually didn't eyesight me fully, and I didn't go left, I went right, and ended up against the pit wall in a bit of a mess, and broke my arm and dislocated my knee and some odds and sods. Not life-threatening in any way. And I only missed one meeting and I came back for the rest of the season and I actually rode pretty well. And I don't know whether that was it. That might have been me frightened. I don't know. I'd never been frightened before about this.
I think you're quite fortunate in a weird way that you had that moment where you knew, because a lot of people, like you said, will drag it out or they'll keep going, or let's say a footballer might have to drop down a division or two, but they're so in love with the sport, they can't admit their legs have gone or they're too old for it or they can't keep up anymore. And at least you had that kind of line in the sand where you went, it's time to walk away, and I'm happy with that, because a lot of people will retire because they have to, because of a bad injury or whatever, and they feel so much resentment against the sport. But I suppose in a weird way, although you probably could have kept going a few more years, it must be quite a nice place to be in, where you controlled your destiny there.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. And something had definitely changed. I still look back and I think I made the right decision at the right time. Didn't want to drag it all out. If you want to go racing for a bit of a thrill, you can go club racing, a bit of classic racing, which I have done. Foggy, looking back now, he hurt himself at the end of... Sorry, beginning, first meeting, wet meeting, beginning of 2000. He'd won the championship in 99. And he ran in the back of somebody in the wet. It was a really hideous meeting. I was racing Supersport at the same meeting. And it was... torrential, and he hit somebody and went down, dislocated his shoulder in a really big way. That was going to be at his age, which was 30s then, was going to be a career ender. And it was devastating. But actually, looking back now, he said, I'm really happy it happened that way, because I wouldn't have ever known when I'd have always believed that I could go and win another championship. And maybe I would have got even worse or faded away and not had a, you know. So he's really quite happy that injury, although not affecting his life much afterwards in terms of everyday life, did stop him racing. So you're right. It's something has to give you the... Something has to be the catalyst, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll tell you what, let's just do a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. I think dovetailing into that, Ewan, it's something that we're fascinated about, isn't it? The TT, we're obsessed with it. We're obsessed with the thrill, the sheer courage, the bravery of the people that take part in that particular race. We spoke to Steve Parrish, and he's described himself as giving the TT about 80% of his capacity, whereas road racing's more of 100% full throttle type thing. Two parts of that question. Given what you've just said there, it sounds to me like you couldn't do a race at 80%. But also, given what the TT's about, and I'm dying to go, I've never been, do you get the feeling with how dangerous that is, if you're not kind of at your absolute top of the game, if luck's not on your side that particular day, that from a health and safety point of view, because it's not as controlled as a track type situation, you're going to see less and less of that. Will we ever get to a stage like, say, that on the Northwest 200, where they say, sorry, it's just too risky, we can't keep going with it?
Well, what you said there, is it, are we going to get a time when they say that this is, you know, who's they? I look at it this way. I did one Manx Grand Prix on a 250 that I borrowed because I was racing 125s at the time. There wasn't a class for that. Then the following four TTs, so 86, 87, 88 and 89 TTs. And I had a one podium over there. What frightened me about the TT, I'm glad I did it, really glad to look back on it and say to people that I did do the TT a few times and did all right. But even at the time, I was never an 85 or 90% man. I would set off down that road and go as fast as I could the whole time. I knew I would have an accident. And if you're going to have an accident and you're at Donington, your chances are you're going to walk back, get your spare bike and go out again the next session. And the chances are very much at the TT or any of them road circuits where that would not be the case. It'd be a big problem. So I took a decision not to do the TT after 89. Luckily, my short circuit career was taking off a little bit anyway. Do I have a lot of respect for these people who do it? You're too right, I do. It's not even a physical thing. I think to ride a motorbike around there at a reasonably quick... I mean, I think 125 miles an hour now on the bikes they've gotten, but the way the road is over there, a 125 lap isn't that special, right? I know that sounds awful, but it isn't. I think that many, many riders would have the talent to do that. If you three quarters of the British Championship paddock, should they choose to put the effort in and immerse themselves in it and do it, they would be able to go that quick or quicker. But the TT is that it's a mental side. It's the fact that if you make one mistake or if the bike, you have a puncture, brake failure, all these things that can happen, a seizure, oil leak, whatever, then this is going to be not a good situation. And you've got to get your head around that. And I remember queuing up on... I mean, I've sat on a lot of grids, World Flipping 500 MotoGP grids, World Superbike, World Supersport Bridge, and I'm nervous. But you're nervous. You know how it is. You're walking out into your flipping arena and the nerves come from the fact that it's the fear of failure. You are there to do a job. You've worked hard to do that job. And if it goes wrong for whatever reason, or you don't perform, then that's where the nerves come. It comes from yourself. But the Isle of Man, you've got all that, but you've also got the little feeling that never really left me. You're queuing up to take your turn to go because they set off. It's not a mass start, so the build-up is, you know, you might be sitting off number 10. You might have 9 riders to go with 10-second intervals before you. So it all builds. And I couldn't help thinking, mate, if you make a mistake in the next hour and a half here, you're pretty much dead. And that is, it's the mental side of the Isle of Man that is the impressive bit, really, you know, for them to sort of keep doing it, that I really respect. And I really respect the idea that they have to be accurate. They've got to be accurate. They can't do a Marc Márquez where they follow 15 times a meeting and just back it off 1%. You know, they can't do that.
Yeah.
They're going to get one go at falling off and it's going to be bad. So there's a respect there.
Taking that into consideration, the mindset of a road racer and the mindset of a MotoGP rider, you've shared podiums and you had some fantastic teammates. You talk really fondly of Foggy, so that might be your answer. But if you could, who's the most talented racer you went up against? Who do you think is the one person you went, yeah, that guy could make a machine work?
Loads of people. And I would hit, I mean, I've been on this, I did a couple of Grand Prix on 500s back in the day when Mick Doohan was still at the top of his game. Been on the same track as Schwantz and Gardner and Rainey and all them people. And I would love to say I went racing with Wayne Rainey and Mick Doohan and Kevin Schwantz, but actually, I was on the same track at the same time. And that is all I'd say. So I can't say I ever raced them. And I never got near enough to them to understand how good they were or not. Probably the most talented man that you've never heard of, you might have heard of him, I was on track with him, and some of the stuff he did, I could not even... Normally, somebody comes past you, you can tag onto them, you can take a risk, stick your neck out a bit, but at least you can see how they're doing what they're doing, right? But there was a guy called Anthony Gobert, right? He was Aussie, came from nowhere, motocross background. He was an absolute flip lid. He was heavy drinking, heavy smoking, party animal, so much natural talent, even he didn't know where it came from. And he came past me in the wet, and I was lying third in a World Superbike race, and he came past me on a worse bike than me. He's on a Bimota. My bike was 10 times the bike he was on. He came past me, and if I'd have tried to go with him, I wouldn't even have given myself 2 corners. I'd have been upside down in the trees. That's how clever he was.
Pure talent combined with stupidity and didn't really care, or what? Or just pure talent?
Bit of everything with him. Right. He was a complete lunatic, but had that much talent. He could just do it. And he didn't know how we were doing it. But he's going into corners, knee on the deck. The front end's gone. It's gone. The thing's ploughing, right? He's ploughing off the track, and he just digs it in and digs it until it comes back, and didn't even lose that much, and did it again the next corner. If that had happened to me once in that race, I'd have pulled in just to say, well, no, I can't get away with that again. But not him. Wow. He was such a clever rider.
Well, that begs the question then, James, with regards to what you're saying there about learning off other people. The fact that you've got the race tuition school, and you're helping to teach and coach riders coming through. How does that then work? Because the skill in what those riders are doing, that you're trying to work out what they're doing, potentially they can't explain that. It then strikes me that your next great skill after being able to ride a bike is to be able to tell people how to ride a bike in a certain particular way and see what ability, either it's natural, as Ewan says, and where needs to be worked on, where needs a rider potentially with the kind of future ahead of them, what to pick out to make them better. That's a real skill in itself.
Yeah, but I think it's probably a skill that most people that have ridden at a reasonable level would have the sort of capacity and ability to do. You're dead right, actually. It ends up being more about spotting what they're not doing than it does spotting what they are doing or what they're doing wrong and getting them to change. A lot of the most common problem for a lot of riders is they push into a corner, which completely ruins the mid-corner and exit. And you've got to get them to almost go slower in certain parts to then gain more coming through and running the speed instead of just been late on the brakes, it's easy to see how we can outbrake somebody. And that's obviously the best way of overtaking somebody. You get as near as you can with a bit of slipstream, and then you sort of get up the inside, you outbrake them. But that generally knackers the corner up in terms of flowing through the corner. So a lot of it becomes being able to spot what they're not doing as opposed to what they are doing.
Can I ask as well, because obviously you're coaching people and there's egos involved, you don't want to hurt people's feelings, but obviously everyone's got a different ceiling. They've got a different level of ability, and you'll come across some people who you teach and go, wow, this person's got it. They're naturally good. I can push them a bit further. How do you politely say to that, I'm not saying middle of the road, say someone like myself or Prutz came to your school and, you know, we're never going to be good. You have to say
shaking
to us, listen,
your head straight away.
Don't go into the corner like he's going into it. You're never going to be that good. So do you have to rein people in a little bit when you teach them? Because everyone's got different limits or
completely. Yeah. All the time. Most of our customers are really the road riders who want to be a little bit safe. I always ask them, before we even start with a debrief and the tuition, I'll say, what are you looking to get out of today? You're looking to be quicker? You're looking, are you ever going racing? And a lot of it, if guys sat in front of you with a two-piece levers and 55-year-old, he ain't going racing at BSB anytime soon. So he's obviously there for some of their to have a ride round with me or with Kyle Ryder or one of the other instructors and just have a good day out. Some want to learn a little bit. You get others who's fallen off at some track day somewhere and they want to get the confidence back. And there's some have some really glaring technique issues that very simply you can give them one or two sort of nuggets of information that'll definitely make a big difference straight away. Other people that are a bit quicker, it's smaller. It's smaller gains. You get some people who try that hard that you've got to slow them down because they're definitely going to hurt themselves. Mm. So it's everybody's a little bit different. And the main thing for us, honestly, is keeping people on two wheels, really. Yeah. Just giving them a safe day, keeping them apart a lot of the time on track. We don't run massive numbers. There's only going to be about 20 on track. So we try and keep it as safe as we can before we do anything else.
James, has there ever been a situation where someone's rocked up and you're thinking, Jesus Christ, you need to get off this track because no matter what I tell you, you're
yeah, loads of times,
and it's going to end badly for all of us here if you do this.
Lots of times. You need a road licence or a race licence, an ACU or international FIM licence to come on any track day because the circuits stipulate that, which is common sense.
Well, but a licence doesn't necessarily equate to common sense, does it? We all know that.
And I've had people on track where you're setting off down pit lane and then setting out onto the track. And I'm looking at them thinking, you're looking at where they're using the brakes. Are they using two fingers on a brake lever or four fingers? Where they're using the clutch, what gear they're in, all the rest of it. And I'm looking at them thinking, how did you get here? How the hell did you manage to navigate and ride this motorbike down from Droitwich or wherever you're from without the most basic idea of the controls somehow? But for the most part, we can get people going and get them going a bit safer. But I mean, there's all sorts. I had a guy come on a track day when I was instructing for a guy called Kevin Healy, Focus Events, if you've heard of them.
Yeah.
A big track day company. And I was instructing at Cadwell, and this guy comes up and he'll give me £25 a session to have some sort of one-to-one. I said, yeah, go on then. And we've done about three sessions, and he's telling me he's going racing with this club and that club. And the dude would be 40, and obviously got a passion. And I said, you haven't started racing yet? He said, no. I said, you do know you haven't got any... I felt like I should tell him. I said, you have no aptitude for this at all. He went, honestly, I went, yeah, you're never going to be a good racer. And he said, yeah, but, you know, I can do my best and I want to do it. And I thought, yeah, fair play to you. So we did a bit more. And the man would ring me up once his career started. He started doing some club racing. And he'd send me a text. I'd be at some BSB meeting at, Brands. He'd be at a club race at Mallory. And he'd send me this text. Yeah, qualified 36th, obviously, you know, barrel. But I'm doing all right and I might just... And then you get one later that I finished 28th, and you're thinking, well, three or four people have fallen off. That's last, basically. And then he sent me one day, and he said, he's at Cadwell, I don't know where I was. He says, I've qualified third row, ... I am having it, right? So he's obviously qualified midway up the grid, and he's decided this is going to be his moment of glory. And then I didn't get anything. I'm expecting some kind of excited text or phone call later that day. Nothing. Rang him the next day. I said, what happened, Paul? He goes, can't believe it. Got all excited. When the lights changed, I flipping looped it off the line. He says, end up with a bike sat on top of me.
But,
bless him.
I love the fact he said, you'll never believe it. No, I absolutely can believe that you've done that because you're useless.
I would definitely believe that, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
Jesus. I mean, there's a little, forgive the pun here, but let's have a slight gear change. I mean, given your ability on a bike, is that shared with your ability with a drum kit?
No, I don't. I'm not doing as much drumming now. With the drumming thing, I did a little bit of drumming at school when I was sort of 12 or 13, really enjoyed it. Who doesn't enjoy making a bit of music with the mate yeah. friend and a kid? You know, I don't know how bad you are. Everybody's got a band at school, haven't they? And then when I got to, I was doing pretty well at racing, I had a bit of time on my hands during the week, I bought another drum kit and just reacquainted myself with being a basic sort of rockish but rubbish drummer. And then, weirdly enough, a motorbike mate of mine called Dave Caldwell, Coddy, lovely, lovely fella, did a bit of club racing, but always lived local, always knew him. And he rang me up and he said, you drumming a bit? I went, yeah. He goes, I don't know if you know, but I'm a reasonable bass, turned out I was a really good bass player. So he came up and we'd just do a bit of jamming. And then, as always happens, somebody else learns that you do, I'd play a bit of lead guitar, so I'll come on. And then before you know it, you've got some kind of band, and we ended up being all right. We had a band called the Poor Boys. We played a few big motorbike gigs. We played World Superbike at Brands a couple of years. We played at Donington. Played at MCN's Bike Fest in April, which is at Butlin's holiday camp. So we did all that, and we did local pubs. But I'm doing less now. I still drum a little bit.
Do you know what, James? It seems to me, I'll call it in retirement. I know you're still working within bikes, but it seems to me like you're in quite a good place. I mean, a lot of people, including myself, you know, you do a competitive sport for a living. As you said earlier, something you love doing. You can't believe you make money from it. It's dangerous. It's thrilling. It's exciting. You're making people proud. When that did stop, I know you said earlier you knew the time was right to stop, but did you find it hard to replace that buzz? Is that why you started drumming and stuff like that? Or are you in a content place? Because you sound like you're in a good place.
No, I never had any problem replacing that because I didn't want to. I was at a time in my life when I didn't need to replace it. I'd almost had enough. You know, I almost didn't want to. It's a weird motorcycling. Motorcycle racing, I really enjoyed. Enjoyed being a bike racer. Enjoyed the notoriety that came with it. But actually, and I think like all competitive sports, it's not. People see you doing your job on a weekend, you know, for a couple of hours. But actually, if you're within that sort of world, for me, it was always a 24-hour a day, 7-day a week job of the pressure or of the thinking about it, of the trying to improve, of the training, of whatever you've got to do. And I think I was ready for a change. And I've missed being good at something because that was my thing I was good at. I'm pretty average at everything else. And I missed the fact that that was my little thing and I don't do it anymore. But I don't actually miss the thrill. It's not like an adrenaline thing. I'm not one of these. I am very unlikely to buy a winged suit and jump off a mountain at any point in the near future, because I'm not really a thrill seeker anymore. You know, I think I've used it up. I think that's, you know, I used all that shit up.
So. Well, that's good because there's so many people who do quit from their living, their chosen lifestyle and miss it so much. Then other things become bad, things become a big part of their life. So I think it's really good that you said, that's it. I'm done. I don't miss it. You know, I miss being good at something, but you know, you're still here. You're alive. You've got a lovely family. It's all good.
James, you say about that the current state of play with that, and we've discussed all manner of things, but on a day-to-day basis, are you still out and about on two wheels? Is it your preferred mode of transport? Do you have a bike or two or three knocking around?
Yeah, I've got loads of motorbikes. I've got a shed that way, a big tin shed that's got an aeroplane, a camper, a load of tyres for my track days, loads of motorbikes, lathes, welding, half of it I don't even know how to use, but I've got all that, and I do like restoring bikes. I have got bikes, I do ride bikes, we do perhaps a couple of, there's a big bunch of us, all ex-racers, a lot of them Scottish, like Neil McKenzie, like Ian Simpson, all ex-British champion, Brian Morrison, and we'll go off on a couple of runs a year. We've done Normandy, we've been down to Verdun, we've done all sort of battlefield tours, you know. Yeah. We've done, what else have we done? Northern Spain in the Pecos, that was brilliant. We've done Southern Ireland, which blew me away, fantastic. And of the 4 days we're in Southern Ireland, it only rained for three of them. It's fantastic.
I love the fact you just said, oh, that way I've got a tin shed with an aeroplane in it, loads of bikes in it. It's just like, I'm sure it's not just a tin shed, but I mean, I don't know anyone ever who said to me, oh yeah, I've got an aeroplane in the garden over there. It's pretty rock and roll.
And I love my life. I've got a really, really good little life. I'm in a nice position where I can work at what I quite enjoy doing anyway, I don't want to be as competitive anymore.
That's my dog getting involved in the chat. Sorry about that.
No, I've got one somewhere. I don't know where he is. He's seen his ass really, because he likes to sit on my knee in the office, and I've shooed him away. So he's actually, I don't know where he's gone, my little fella.
It's seen.
He probably sat in the aeroplane.
Yeah,
but he don't like it. You know what? I've got little Jack Russell, he's 3 or 4 year old now, and he'll travel in the car all right, or the van. But I thought, right, I'll put him in the aeroplane and I'll just taxi up and down. I won't go flying yet. I'll just see if he, because some dogs love it. You do get people arriving here for a trip out with a dog with them. They do travel pretty well, some dogs. And he just didn't like it. He was not a natural flyer. So we never went flying. He got very nervous. Probably didn't trust me. They've been all right with anybody else.
Yeah, the dog's just looking across. I don't think you've got a natural aptitude for this, James. I'm getting... Which, I mean, is even. I mean, that's an even bigger threat if you haven't got that with flying a plane. I know bikes are dangerous, but if someone's in a plane with you going, Jesus.
It's the same thing. And do you know what you said there? I know bikes are dangerous. That is a perfect thing to say, because if you get into any of these things... Not just bikes. There's lots of sports. You've got to go in there knowing what the pitfalls are. And to keep yourself safe, you need to understand that there's an inherent danger. Well, flying's the same. Unless you ride your motorbike properly and you acquire the required sort of skill set, then you are. It is a dangerous thing. You know, flying's the same. You've got to do your job properly to make it as safe as what it can be. So that is the same skill set as bikes and airplanes. I've never known anybody who can ride a bike properly who didn't take to flying like a duck to water. Never.
I mean, the mind boggles with that, Ewan, doesn't it? I'm trying to think, can we ride bikes properly? All it needs
I'm only just mastering riding a bike. I'm never going to try and fly a plane, mate.
But knowing you and your love for customization, you'd need some big daft thing with a dragon on the side.
I'd want it to spit flames, not in a bad way. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Lift the loop and all that type of stuff.
You always get asked, I get asked quite a bit, will you provide it? Well, you'll be the same. Can you provide a shirt for a charity auction, or can you give us a raffle item? And I've got less and less of stuff that I had when I raced, less and less posters and team shirts and that left. In fact, virtually nothing now. So I'll take a couple of people for a flight around the local area, like a pleasure flight, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, right. And a couple of them said, can you laminate us like a piece of, you know, like a voucher. So we've actually got something to give out on the night. So the first time we did it, I just went on flipping clip art and got a little aeroplane going along with a flame out the back of it, right? And a little parachute going down the other side of the page and said, this is a voucher, you know, it entitles you to a flight for two around the Huddersfield area. And nobody said anything. I thought it was really funny that I put a burning aeroplane on a voucher for a pleasure flight. And they came and they enjoyed it. And yeah.
Didn't want to question the fact that it looked like it was potentially on fire.
Yeah.
James, I'm absolutely loving this chat, but we are going to run out of time soon. A couple of final questions, if I may. Firstly, I have to ask, you've had such a varied career and life. What is the most proud moment or the most fond moment of riding bikes when you look back? Is there one moment that stands out?
Probably. I mean, I think I'm most proud of being able to do something to that level that I never thought I would. I think I'm proud of that. I mean, I always say I've managed to avoid having a proper job for 40 years. And actually, I left school in 1983. I was class of 83 from a local comprehensive. And I've actually pretty much been semi-retired since I left that school at 16. That's what I feel like. If I had to pick one moment out, I ended up winning or a manage to win a real nip and tuck 5 minute at the front like it always is. Monza, slipstream battle in Supersport. Monza's a big old school. They don't go anymore, but it's got two 1 mile straights. So slipstreaming is the thing. And when you're in a slipstreaming battle, you can do all the thinking you want and ride as hard as you want. You can get nabbed on the line by somebody slipstreaming. It's never a given. And you're never going to get away because people just slipstream themselves back onto your back wheel or you do with somebody else. And I won in front of a load of team guests because the team were based a mile from the circuit. So we had a lot of team sponsors there, guests. It was packed. And it was Italian team, obviously. And I won 2001 Supersport World Championship race, and that was a big moment. That was a but pretty much because it was in front of the team. Really, yeah. I remember that quite fondly.
Let's get to our fantasy ride question. I mean, what you've given us so much to laugh about, James, and so much to really really think about. So our final one to you is a fantasy ride, please. We want to know where you'd be going, what bike you would be riding, who you would be with. And potentially, given the fact that you are a mean drummer on the side, what would you be listening to?
Listening to any kind of... My go-to listening would be 80s, 90s, because it's my time. I like quite a lot of modern music. I like quite a lot of music that's older than that. I really respect younger people these days because they are much more likely to look at every kind of genre. We were broke to believe you couldn't like Elvis because your dad liked him and, you know... So you have to move on now. I think they're a lot more accepting. So music-wise, it'd probably be 80s or 90s, some kind of mixtape of that. I like most of it. And where would it be going? Probably I would... I'll tell you what's a nice ride. Get out, go out east. Go out what used to be the east. So go out to Czech Republic or... Mm-hmm. We had a lovely ride to Chemnitz, which was brilliant. The people were lovely. We've done Berlin as well, which was fantastic. So I would go east Europe or America. Saying that, I've done quite a lot of the things. We did a Route 66, four of us, you know.
That was amazing.
Unbelievable. Never went above 60 mile an hour. Yeah. Sun shone for the most part. Yeah, so that's it. I'd have another run through Route 66 and I would take a few of my old racing buddies who I don't see much anymore. So Mike Hale, who is an American, who I don't see much anymore, was teammates with him. Paolo Cazzole, who was my teammate at Belgada. Mayo Merigali, who was also my teammate at Belgada, who's now head of Yamaha MotoGP. Lovely fella. And anybody I race with in Britain, I'd like a big bunch of us to go out. And I think road biking is something you get into when you're old. I think it's, I think you can enjoy it a lot more when you're not racing, to be honest. And
What bike are you riding? It's going to be something comfortable.
Well,
yeah.
In a way, it wouldn't really bother me. If I was on track, you want a proper thing that's doing its job. But actually, if you're just going out for a ride with your mates, it's less important. If somebody came with a flipping cruiser, he's still coming with us and he's still having a good time, even though you're on an adventure bike or whatever. At the minute, I run a Tenere Yamaha with all the
love
bits
those.
And bombs. We do a bit of traily stuff. And so I'd take my Tenere, that's happy enough. As long as he's got heated grips.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, the practicalities come into it as I was over in Blackpool and a couple of other places in the last week, and so thankful for being a total wuss and having a full set of heated gear that goes under my actual gear. I was
how good is it though?
Thank God.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely stuff. That's about it for our full chat this week. Of course, it's powered by Bikeshore. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshore will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
It's been an absolute blast. A massive thanks to this week's special guest, the brilliant James Whittam. Thanks, James.
Thanks, boys.
James, it's been wonderful, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.